One of the criticisms that I used to receive when I was first involved in advocating for the acceptance of homosexual people in the church was that I was risking the church's reputation and God's reputation, because it was essential that the church always maintain the highest standards of moral behaviour and maintain a clear and safe distance from any whiff of sin and or scandal. And so there were actually those who thought that I might be right, that homosexuality might not be the great sin that the church had made it out to be, but who rather timidly felt that it was best to maintain the status quo because the presence of such people raised too many complicated ethical questions and was likely to confuse the people and cloud our witness to solid family values. One of the most deep-seated and unhelpful myths about the meaning of Christian faith is that it is primarily focused on getting us all to behave, to conform with a set of good moral behaviours. So the basic message is presented as, Jesus died for you, now behave. The gospel. And of course, it's not only gay people who have been made to feel like unwanted failures by such teachings. Most of us carry things in our pasts or in the secret desires of our hearts that would have us thrown out of many churches if it were made known. Of course, anything to do with sex is especially likely to invoke guilt and anxiety. And among the problems with this view of Christianity is that it is thoroughly unbiblical and thoroughly inconsistent with the life and witness of Jesus. Now, if that claim seems a little far-fetched, then you need go no further than the opening chapter of the New Testament, part of which we heard as our gospel reading tonight. Judging by the things that it emphasises, Matthew's gospel was written to a church whose people were prone to thinking that the most important thing was keeping pure and maintaining strict moral standards. And Matthew begins shaking them up right from the get-go. The only thing that comes before the story that we heard tonight is a rather lengthy family tree of Jesus. It's not very often read in church because it's mostly just 42 lines of so-and-so was the father of so-and-so, and so it doesn't sound very interesting. And many of the names are not actually that easy for Westerners to pronounce either, so it doesn't get read that often. But for those with eyes to see, there is some hidden excitement in it. And it's worth a quick look here because it relates to what I've just been saying, and it's actually quite important in the way that it sets up the story that we heard about Mary and Joseph. The 42 lines mostly follow a repetitive pattern. This bloke was the father of that bloke, and that bloke was the father of another bloke, and so on and so on and so on. But every now and again, just five times out of the 42, it breaks the rhythm and names the mother as well as the father. So if you're reading the whole thing out loud, it's the names of the five mothers that kind of wake you up and grab your attention as you go. Now, the fifth one is Mary, the mother of Jesus, but the other four are all well known to those who know the Hebrew Bible stories. And none of them are role models of sexual modesty that the moral majority want their daughters to grow up to be and their sons to grow up to marry. In fact, all four of them are associated with some sort of sexual scandal, and at least three of them are also Gentile outsiders. The first one, Tamar, disguised herself as a prostitute to have sex with the father of her dead husband and publicly expose him for failing to fulfil his social obligations. Rahab was a foreign prostitute. Ruth was a Gentile woman who seduced a Jewish man and then got him to marry her. And Bathsheba was the married woman who King David dragged off to bed and then had her husband murdered in order to try and cover it up. So Matthew's choice of who to highlight in Jesus' family tree is not good news for the traditional family values lobby. Then, having drawn our attention to this lineup of sexual scandal, Matthew names a fifth mother, Mary, and then takes us straight into the story that we heard tonight, which of course is a story about how Mary's pregnancy caused a scandal in her hometown and nearly cost her at least her husband, if not her life. The story tells us that Mary was found to be pregnant before she was married. Now that branded her straight away in the town as an adulterer, because although she was not yet married, she was already betrothed to Joseph. And in that culture, betrothal was a lot more binding than engagement is in ours. Joseph knew enough about the facts of life to know that since he hadn't had sex with Mary, somebody else had. And he knew enough about biblical law and about the cultural norms of his society to know that it was not the right thing to do to marry a woman who was carrying somebody else's child. Now, of course, even apart from the sense of hurt and betrayal that he would have been feeling, Joseph had his own reputation to think of. And sticking with Mary was an absolute no-win for him. If it became known that his girl was carrying someone else's child, he would be humiliated. And if it was thought that the child was his, then his reputation as a respectable and honourable young man was shot, since they hadn't got married yet. Premarital sex may not cause much angst nowadays, but it certainly did then. So either way, he loses. So the only right thing for him to do is to sever ties with Mary, and his only real choices are whether to make a public issue of it or not. If he does, he draws more attention to his own embarrassment, and there's a possibility that Mary will end up stoned to death. And he's not up for that, so he opts to make the best of a bad situation and cut off the betrothal quietly. Mary will still be disgraced and be left pretty much unmarriable, but if she keeps herself and her illegitimate child behind closed doors, she should at least survive. But then a messenger from the Lord turns up in a dream and tells Joseph that it was God who impregnated his girl and that he should go ahead and marry her. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm Joseph and somebody turns up and confesses to having impregnated my fiancée, I don't much care whether he happens to be God. I'm not happy about it. And I'm certainly not taking orders from him, especially when those orders are essentially about covering up for him, shouldering the blame myself, and raising his illegitimate child as though it was my own. It's not a good deal. You caused the problem, God, you fix it. Count me out. But Joseph seems to be a man of rather more nobility of spirit than me, and he's up for the challenge of cooperating with whatever the hell it is that God is up to here. Now, there's no good news for the traditional family values lobby or the sexual morality police here. They have, of course, tried to wriggle out of it by focusing on Mary and Joseph as models of premarital sexual abstinence. But the fact is that if God thinks it's terribly important that he and his followers have nothing to do with anything that contains a whiff of scandal or suspect morality, then God really stuffed up this time round. Because it is only by pretending that this story has no biblical context and no social context at all that you can hold it up as some kind of eulogy to virginity. The way Matthew sets up the story, he makes it very clear that not only is this a scandalous situation, but it comes from a long family history of infamous sexual scandals. Now, that might not be good news for those who want religion to be all about policing people's behaviour, but it is very, very good news for pretty much everyone else. Whatever it is in your past or even your present that you thought put you undoubtedly on the outer with God and made you a person who could never be someone that God would want to be associated with or someone that God might ask for help in bringing about the things that God is doing in the world, then this story tells you that God is not nearly so precious about his reputation, and that God is not only working in and through those who have managed to live up to some standard of squeaky clean moral perfection. If you are gay, or if you once had an affair, or an abortion, or you worked in the sex industry, or you've fallen foul of some other standard of social acceptability, and you've been told or made to feel by some church that you are thus a leper for life and can never be more than a second-class Christian, then grab a hold of this first chapter of Matthew. And know that God is a lot more willing to be associated with you than with the sorts of judgmental moral crusaders that would cut you off. When God takes the big actions to send his love into the world in a tangible human form, he is just as likely to do it through people just like you. And let me conclude with a more general observation as well. One of the reasons that the traditional family values crusaders use the word traditional is that they assume that things have been better in the past and that new changes usually take us onto slippery slopes of sin and wickedness, and that therefore maintaining healthy morality means maintaining the things the way they've been before. But God does not seem to be on about doing things the same old way all the time. God frequently wants to do something new, something unprecedented. No God has become human before. No God has allowed himself to be crucified by his own creatures before. And no God has raised a dead person to life and glorified him as Lord of all before. But because religious people are always so prone to mistaking opposition to change for faithfulness, they are almost always scandalized when God begins doing anything new. Just look at the Jesus story. He's born in scandal and he dies in scandal, and then his body goes missing and there's more scandal still. And God is thoroughly in the thick of it all, and the religious people have got their noses right out of joint over it. They are far too scandalized to get on board with God. So when you hear religious people saying that we can't ordain women or we can't accept homosexuals or we can't criticise governments or oppose wars because the church has a long history and we've never done it this way before, don't assume that that settles it. For it is just as likely, and maybe even more likely, to be a sign that God is well and truly involved and is challenging us to accept the incarnation of love in new ways. Even if it be as startling as a virgin birth in questionable circumstances or a resurrection from the dead. God's new world is coming, and God is not going to let the moral scruples of the religiously unimaginative and hung up derail it or get in the way. Come, Lord Jesus, come.